This is Ron Stockton.
This is the first lecture on the unit on liberation theology. I think I'm going to take the advice of the learning specialists on campus and maybe break this up into three or four different shorter lectures rather than longer lectures. Liberation theology was a term invented by a man named Gustavo Gutierrez, Gutierrez. He's a priest. He's a Peruvian. I met him once. In the 1980s, the University of Michigan had a visiting theologian series. They would bring a theologian out, some famous theologian, in the winter semester, I think. And this person would teach a class, a seminar for graduate students or undergraduates, I can't remember, a small number of handpicked students, and then would deliver a public lecture on Wednesday night. And the idea was that the theologian would use this time to write a book, and each of those lectures would be turned into a book chapter. So Father Gutierrez delivered a series of lectures, and I said to my students, this is a remarkable opportunity to listen to one of the great theologians, so let's go hear him. So I went over, I think, four times maybe. My class went over once, but I went over other times myself. And once I spoke to him briefly. I'll talk about that in a minute. He was sort of a funny-looking man. He was rather short. He had on a dark suit, no tie. He looked as if he had bought this in a Salvation Army, and it didn't quite fit. He looked a bit disheveled. He speaks English very clearly, but he does have an accent of a non-native speaker. He coined the word liberation theology and wrote a book of that title. That book was renounced by Cardinal Ratzinger. We've talked about him. He later became Pope Benedict. He was sort of John Paul's enforcer. And he was writing herd on Latin American theologians who were presenting views that he didn't like to hear. So Father Gutierrez knew that he had a file on himself. Someone had a file on him, and everything he said was being monitored. So it was very interesting what he said. He said, theology doesn't, he said, traditional theology arises at dusk. When the sun goes down, some famous theologian will go in his office and write something. And he said, that's a certain kind of theology. He said, he says there's no such thing as neutral theology. No theology is neutral. It's all situated within a political and power structure. And so you have to think of it that way or you won't understand. He said that traditionally, theologians had all been white. They had been Europeans. They had been privileged. He said, as a result of that, they reflect certain views and certain perspectives. They're not intentionally being propagandists for the power structure, but that's what it amounts to. But he said, there's another kind of theology, which doesn't come from the top down. He said, that's what you get if you study theology, if you become a priest and you study theology. This is top-down theology. It comes from these great people. He said, there's another kind of theology which comes from the bottom up. It's from the people who are on what he calls the underside of history. These are the people that nobody knows their name. Hurrah for those who never invented anything. That's a line from a poem by a black poet, a Caribbean poet. He said, women are the underside too. He mentioned black people are the underside, Asians, Africans. These people are the underside. He says, women are the underside too. He said, if we look at, he said, the task of someone, of the modern theologian, is to take the point of view of the poor. Much of the world, a majority, he says, lives in poverty. He says, this is not just a local condition. Poverty is a global condition. Ah, you remember Rerum Novarum really focused on what was happening within your own country. He says, no, it's a global condition. And he said, the church in Latin America has been responding to this. And they spoke of a preferential option for the poor. Oh, we've heard that phrase before. He mentioned a couple of conferences, Medellin and Puebla. Those are two places in, Medellin is in Mexico, and Puebla is in, it's not in Mexico also, is it? I've forgotten. I'm so sorry. And he said, all right, take my own case. He says, I live in a poor parish. He says, I'm not poor. He says, my family's wealthy, actually. I could live in a very nice house. But how could I possibly serve the needs of my parish? He's still a priest, you know. He still does mass and hears confession and does. He's a famous theologian. He's a guest theologian at the University of Michigan, but he still walks around and baptizes babies and things of that nature. He said, how can I possibly say to people, give them advice or guidance on what to do with their lives if I didn't live among them? He said, I'm never hungry. There are people in my parish who are hungry. I'm never hungry. I have a house. There are people who really don't have a house. He said, where does theology come from? It comes from interaction with real people. He said, I'm a pastor. I encounter a person. That person has a problem. Out of that problem, I develop an insight into what God would have me do. That's what theology is. From a pastoral question, you have theological insights. From theological insights, you have someone like me writing a book. The book did not come out of my head. It didn't come from reading other books, certainly. It came from mixing with real people. Theology grows out of our existence. It's situational, which means that a theology that I work out in a slum in Peru can't be transplanted to another place. The ideas can be transplanted and someone can develop their own theology, but all theology is local. That's so interesting. And he says, theology exists in history. It exists in the fact that people are living today under a certain circumstance. History, he says, is the place where God and humans meet. That's a very deep, deep concept. And he said, we come in with ideas. He said, from the outside, we come in with ideas. Oh, they're poor people. They're facing this problem. Oh, these are Indian people in Latin America. They've got unique problems, don't they? The native peoples, they're different. He says, here's the problem. He says, once we come in with categories, our categories deceive us. I love that phrase. Our categories deceive us. I've quoted that multiple times throughout my career. because we come in with our ideas and try to impose our ideas on somebody else. This is the problem of the foreign missionary. Foreign missionaries come in and they don't really know what's going on locally. And they come in with ideas that they've learned in seminary or they've learned somewhere else. They've learned from reading a book. And then they get in there and they suddenly encounter real people. And they discover that what they thought, if their minds are open and if they're listening, they discover that what they thought is not the reality. He says we can actually look to the Bible for insight. The essential story of the Old Testament is breaking free of enslavement in Egypt. The people in Egypt were slaves, and they broke free. They were strangers in their own land. They lived in Egypt, but they were strangers. Why? Because the power structure defined what an Egyptian was. They were not a part of the power structure, therefore they are strangers. And they had to break forth and form their own country, their own community. He says today, the poor are strangers in their own land. We don't even know who they are. They're not anybody. We just put them in a category. The slums, the ghettos, the impoverished, the shirtless ones, descamisados, the people who are just so poor they don't even have shirts, the terrorists, the radicals, the revolutionaries, the Marxists. We put them in categories. We don't even think of human beings. I once spent an evening at a house in the West Bank, the Palestinian West Bank. I was a guest in the house. One of the men in the house, my host, was a supporter of Yasser Arafat and Fatah. His brother, who was sitting right there, was a supporter of Hamas. And yet I was just sitting there with them, eating pastries and having coffee. Suddenly, I couldn't see the difference between them. My host said, you know, we're of different parties, but the fact is we're all in favor of supporting the Palestinians. Okay, here is what Gutierrez says. You can't come in with categories. Your categories will lead you astray. They'll deceive you. You've got to talk to real people. Find out what their problem is. Their problem is, they're not real people in their own country. They're strangers in their land. And he says to be poor is to be insignificant. When you die, you just become a statistic if you're lucky. Nobody really cares that you died. Nobody who counts cares that you died. Obviously, your family cares that you died. But of those people who are important, they just say, well, I'm so sorry, these people are dying. He says, the fact is the church is not comfortable among the poor. The church doesn't really. The church has teachings on the poor. You look after them. You help them. You give them charity. You try to uplift them. But it doesn't say you try to get to know them. That's the pastoral duty of the priest. Okay, what is the priest supposed to be doing? Preaching? Orthodoxy? Preaching? Orthodoxy. Ortho means truth. Doxy means to speak. Orthodoxy means to preach God's truth. He says, no, it's orthopraxis. You're supposed to practice what God wants. You're supposed to live among the poor, get dirty with them, grieve with them, understand them, encounter them, which is not what most people do. They don't encounter people. He says the church is very comfortable when the members of the church are comfortable. But when they're not comfortable, when they're poor, when they're wretched, when they're dirty, when they smell bad, they're not comfortable. The church doesn't know what to do with them. He's accused of being a Marxist. He says, I'm not a Marxist. He says, there are certain things that Marx taught. He said, I'm really a social scientist. I'm trying to study society and to try to figure out what my Christian religion, my pastoral obligation, my obligation to be a pastor, to look after the needs of people, that's more important. That's what I'm trying to figure out what to do. And if I can use some ideas from Marx, that's fine. But basically, my training, he said, is in psychology. I studied Freud. I'm not a Freudian, but Freud gave us some ideas and insights which help us understand human beings, and therefore I'll use some of Freud. Marx gave us some ideas. I'll use some of Marx, but I'm not a Marxist. I'm not a Freudian. He's been accused of that. I spoke to him afterwards, and I said to him, you know, I'm using some chapters from your book in my class. And he said, well, there are a few things in there that I got wrong. He didn't say what he got wrong, but he had been warned by Cardinal Ratzinger that he was flirting with non-Christian ideas. And he was saying the right thing. This is Father Gutierrez. This is his concept of liberation theology. Theology is something that you live. Theology is what a pastor does when the pastor goes to talk to someone who is a drug dealer. What do you say to someone who's a drug dealer? Stop being a drug dealer? Well, you can say that. But you talk to that person. Understand them. Try to figure out what they do is right and what they do is wrong. He says poor and good are not the same thing. There are a lot of poor people who are not good. This is another way where our categories deceive us. Oh, the poor, they're so benighted, they're so honorable. No, he says they're not. To understand why liberation theology, which is very revolutionary, it's got revolutionary dimensions to it. I mean political revolution. I mean throwing over governments. We'll talk about that in a minute. But to understand the world in which liberation theology emerged, we have to look at some things involving Latin America. So let's go back to the 1980s. Or 70s, 1970s might be better. And when there were revolutions going on in El Salvador and Nicaragua and several other countries, Bolivia, Peru, places like that. Let's take one of these countries, like Colombia. There was a famous priest, Camilo Torres was his name, Camilo Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S. C-A-M-I-L-L-O, Camilo Torres. And he was a liberation theologian, and he was a revolutionary. He got involved, they got his hands dirty. He got involved in revolution. Let's look at the country that he was from, the country of Colombia. As with other countries in that region, El Salvador, Nicaragua, something like 3 or 4% of the population controlled 2/3 of the land. These are countries where most people live on the land. They're farmers. And yet the 1%, you might say, control 2/3 of the land. In El Salvador, they used to talk about the 14 families. There weren't really 14 of them, but that was kind of a metaphor, that there are 14 families that run everything. And these are called the oligarchs. And they actually had elections in those days and in those countries. And you got to choose one oligarch's son or the other oligarch's son. Okay, shall we vote for this oligarch or that oligarch? Which one? Well, I guess that's democracy, if by democracy you mean getting to vote. But is that really democracy? How can there be democracy when 2 or 3% of the population control 2/3 of the land? In such a place, There is very low life expectancy. Not many people live to be their 70 as promised in the Bible. So very few people live that way. Life expectancy tends to be low. Child mortality tends to be very high. So the average life expectancy is sometimes, you know, in the 40s. There's very little medical care. If you get sick, good luck. You may have a nurse if you're lucky. There may be a clinic of some kind, and you could go in and there'll be a nurse there, and maybe they'll give you some kind of tablets or something. But you're not going to get very much medical care. Very few people are illiterate. There's mass illiteracy. The government doesn't provide schools for people. They may some, but they're not. Most people can't go to those. So there's big illiteracy. There's unemployment. But there's also underemployment. Underemployment means you have a job, but you may be only working a few hours or a couple days of the week. So how are you going to make a living? You're not. That's simple, you're not. You're going to live in wretched poverty. There's landlessness. Most people don't own land. This is a place where people live on the land. What do? They work on somebody else's land. If they're lucky, they could get a job maybe. But there's landlessness. There's misutilization of land. What do I mean by that? I mean, in many of these countries, okay, ask yourself, how many of you had coffee this morning? Okay, don't raise your hands. It's okay. How many of you had a banana this morning with your cereal? Ooh, that's nice. I love bananas. Anybody have pineapple recently? You realize that those coffee, tea, bananas, those come mostly from poor countries. So a place in Nicaragua, for example, would export a lot of coffee. You know what? If they're exporting coffee, they're not growing crops. Much of the land in these countries, where 3% own 2/3 of the land, that land is used for commercial agriculture, not for subsistence. Subsistence means you grow food that you consume. Okay, if you look at the very high level of agricultural exports, land exports from a poor agricultural country, that tells you there's vast social injustice. You can say, well, the government's making a lot of money. Aren't they running programs? Well, dream on. No, they're not running programs. The government is not there to run programs for the poor. No. They're not there to pass laws which prevent buildings from being built in such a way that they fall down every time the ground shakes. No, that's not what they do. The government is there to extort money and to look after themselves. There's also land that's underutilized. I mean, suppose you meet someone, and a fellow student, and this person says, this person is from, let's say, Nicaragua, and they say, well, I want you to come with me over the Christmas break. We'll go down, and it's great. My family will be there. You can stay at our house. It's good. We have horses. We'll go riding. It's a lot of fun. So you say, this is great, and you go down there, and they have a really beautiful house. And they've got servants, and the servants are so polite and so nice and so helpful. And your friend says, let's go horse riding. So you get on the horses, and you ride for miles and miles and miles, and there's nothing there except horse riding. Okay, think about this. You could take that vast estate and break that estate up and create 50-acre farms and provide a livelihood for 500 people, 500 families. Wouldn't that be amazing? That's underutilization of land. The land is not utilized. Okay, keep these concepts in mind. When we get to Populorum Progressio, we're going to see that these issues are addressed. By the way, do you know that half of the commercially grown corn, maize, in Mexico is fed to cattle, which are exported to the United States? Do you know that The United States is a major producer of beef. But you know what? We have to import beef. You know why? Because of Big Macs and those sorts of things. We just consume beef. So I would say to keep in mind that the next time you get a Big Mac attack, remember that the victim of the attack is a Mexican child. There's poverty. There's hunger in Mexico. I don't mean to overstate this. There are really nice places in Mexico, but there's a lot of poverty, a lot of injustice. And they export food from a country where people are hungry. You see, this is why Father Gutierrez says, poverty is an international problem, and it's a political problem. It's not just an economic problem. In a country like this, there's a limited internal market. There are some people who are very wealthy. Your friend in Nicaragua is going to show you're going to have a TV. He's going to be able to watch. He's going to have cable if you want to watch a Rose Bowl game or something New Year's Day. You're going to be able to do that. They'll have a modern car. Everything is modern. But if you look where the servants live, it's not so nice. And if you go for a ride through the villages, you'll see poverty, and your friend will say something about how, you know, some of the people here just, they just don't put an effort forth or something. There's some rationale that people make to explain away poverty. So there's a limited internal market. If you want to build up an economy, it's pretty hard to do that because there's a limited number of people. Why don't you produce your own TVs instead of importing them? Well, really, how many people are going to buy a TV? A lot of people can't afford a TV. What about the cars that they produce, that Ford produces in Puebla, Mexico? Well, I'm sure some of them are driven by Mexicans, but the whole idea is that they're exported to the United States. That's a controversial issue. We Detroiters know all about that. These regimes are corrupt. They know that someday there's going to be an uprising and they're going to have big problems. So they're taking the money that they've managed to steal and they're exporting it to foreign Miami banks. The Pope talks about that too. When we get to Popular and Progressio, there's a dual economy. There's the modern economy. If you get sick while you're down there with your friend, they're going to take you to the hospital. It's going to be a really good hospital. You're going to have a doctor who speaks English. They're going to have all the modern equipment. They're going to take very, very good care of you. But if the peasant gets the very same thing you've got, what does that person do? There's no hospital for the peasants. That's not the way it goes. So there's a dual economy, a modern economy such as we would recognize, with all sorts of goods, whatever you want to buy, you can buy them. And then there's a peasant economy. They're separate. This regime is corrupt, so they've taken a lot of debt. They've got a lot of loans from foreign banks. They've stolen much of that money, and they export it and hide it in banks in Miami or somewhere else. There's constant uprising. So many of the young sons of the oligarchs go to the United States to study in what was called the School of the Americas. They've renamed it, but the School of Americas trained people in counterterrorism. Well, in a country like this, what is terrorism? It's an uprising of peasants trying to get treated better. That's what it is. In a country like Venezuela that had oil, that oil is mostly controlled by Western companies and they export their profits. And there's something that we don't think about, really. We outsiders don't think about it, but there's an ethnic split within those countries. There are very large indigenous populations. We don't see this, but Latin America was conquered by the Spanish. And they created a dual system. There was the Spanish regime, and then there were the native peoples. And in time, the native peoples were all forced to learn Spanish, so we call them Hispanics. I once referred to Hispanics in a class, and I had a student who was from Mexico. And she said, she was very polite, but she said, "Don't call us Hispanics. The Spanish forced us to learn this language. It's now our language, but it's not really our language. And so you should call us something else," whatever she wanted to be called. But I thought that was very interesting. We don't recognize this. But you know what? I went to Cancun once for a spring break. My wife found a cheap flight down there for $500 or something. So we went down and spent a week there in Cancun. And when you're there, that's in Mexico, on the shore, on the eastern coast. And so while you're there, there are day trips you can take. And if you take those day trips, you're in southern Mexico. The people are really different. I don't know what you think a Mexican looks like, but I'll tell you, this is not what you're thinking. These people are very short, 5 feet maybe. I'm talking the men now, 5'2" maybe. Their faces are square. They really look different. You could tell these are indigenous people. That's not, but I have an assignment for you. Take, after this is over, Google the photos of the last 5 presidents of Mexico and see what they look like. Look at their faces. They look like they could be out of a Goya painting of some Spanish aristocrat. They have these long, elegant-looking faces. That's not what I saw when I was in southern Mexico. It was really different. Those people are being really marginalized. I once had a class, my revolution class, we were talking about genocides. And I said, and so I outlined for the students, where are there genocides? I said, okay, where could it, we outlined the conditions where a genocide might take place. And I said, okay, where do you think would be the next genocide? And one of the students, she was from southern Mexico. And she was a native person, you could tell from her build and her features. And she said, "It's already happening." And I said, "Where is it happening?" And she said, "It's happening in southern Mexico." She said, "The police are going in and killing people and driving them off of their land so that the oligarchs could take over those estates, those lands, and expand their estates." I thought, my goodness. This is the kind of situation that you have. I didn't even know that. This was the Chiapas Uprising, Chiapas, I think. And so that was the revolution of the day. Infant mortality tends to be very high. In the United States, we lose about 8 babies per 1,000 live births. In Peru, they lose 82. In Bolivia, they lose 123. That's over 10% of all the babies die. My goodness. You also have the reality of American domination. We're going to talk about that. I think we'll save that for a second talk. There's a term I want you to remember. It's comprador, C-O-M-P-R-A-D-O-R, comprador. This is an old Marxist term, but it's not really a Marxist term. It's one of those terms, I think the Marxists just borrowed it from someone. It means a regime which actually is not looking out for its own people. They are connected. You know, let's go back a minute. Lenin wrote in 1916, he wrote a very famous essay on imperialism. And I can reduce it down to a kind of a simple thesis that in the old days, there was colonialism in which the British or the French or someone would go in and take over a territory and govern it directly. They would send in a governor and they'd send in an army and they would send in administrators and they would govern it. That's colonialism. Imperialism is different. Imperialism means that there is an enormously powerful Western economic political system. They have taken over the resources of your land and created a government, installed a government of their satisfaction. And that government is made up of people who get enormous benefits out of cooperating with these foreign powers. So you cooperate with the mining company, you cooperate with the oil company, you cooperate with whatever it may be. This government, the leaders of this government are called compradors. They basically are not serving the interests of their own country. They're in power, and they stay in power because Western powers benefit them, provide them financial assistance, provide them military assistance, arms, shipments, whatever they need to stay in power. These are the compradors. This is the situation that you found in the 1960s and 70s when you began to have uprisings in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador. Other places also like Bolivia and Peru and some poorer countries, and even Brazil had some uprisings. So let's call this a wrap, and we're going to come back in a minute for me, maybe in a minute for you also, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the events in Latin America that provide a context for the emergence of liberation theology. Then I think I'll summarize some teachings of liberation theology in a short third lecture, and then in a fourth talk, we will look at Populorum Progressio. How does that sound? Okay, I'll see you in a minute. For me anyway. Bye-bye.